for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. NATO leaders meeting in a Brussels summit turned their attention Thursday to the war in Afghanistan. President Ashraf Ghani and Ukraine's leader Petro Poroshenko will join summit leaders. Wednesday, it was largely about President Donald Trump's complaints. America's NATO partners are not paying more for their own defense.
Since our last meeting, commitments have been made for over $40 billion more money spent by other countries. So that's a step, but it's a very small step. It sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But it's a very small amount of money relative to what they owe and to what they should be paying.
Mr. Trump took aim at allies who haven't yet reached an agreed-to goal of 2% of gross domestic product for defense. But NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg insisted progress has been made.
We have a way to go, but the good news is that we have really started to deliver.
Mr. Trump also criticized Germany for signing a multi-billion-dollar Baltic Sea pipeline deal to import Russian gas, saying Berlin was a captive of Russia. Wednesday, he met on the sidelines with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who said they had a good exchange of views on a range of issues and wished to continue bilateral cooperation. NATO Wednesday also agreed to invite Macedonia to begin accession talks after resolving a name dispute with Greece. Zimbabwe's main opposition party marched to the Independent Election Agency Wednesday, demanding a fair national vote later this month. Among those taking part, Jacob Mafume.
The election will not take place if it is not in compliance with the law and the rules of transparency and accountability.
Voters will choose a president and members of parliament July 30th. This will be the first election since the removal last November of longtime ruler Robert Mugabe. This is VOA News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met Wednesday in Moscow with Russian President Vladimir Putin for talks believed to have focused on Iran's presence in Syria. Trinity University history professor David Lesh said Israel-Iran tensions are the most worrisome in the Syrian conflict.
You know, of all the many fronts in Syria, the one between Israel and the Assad government, particularly its Iranian backers, is by far, in my opinion, the most dangerous of spiraling out of control from a domestic scenario to a regional conflict.
Mr. Netanyahu said his latest trip to Moscow was another opportunity to act together to stabilize the situation. He said Iran needs to leave Syria. The Jewish state remains on alert as pro-government forces consolidate their grip on formerly rebel-held territory in southwest Syria near the Jordanian and Israeli frontiers. China has expressed shock at a U.S. decision to add another $200 billion worth of Chinese products that are to be subject to 10% tariffs by the end of August over Chinese trade and economic practices. It vowed to take the matter to the World Trade Organization. Wang Shuwen, Vice Minister of Commerce, addressed the matter before the WTO Wednesday in Geneva.
The multilateral trading system is now confronted with severe challenges. We would like to call on all WTO members to resolutely defend the fundamental principles and the core values of the multilateral trading system.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry described the tit-for-tat tariff war with the U.S. between a fight between unilateralism and multilateralism. The U.S. has already imposed tariffs on a variety of Chinese imports, totaling $50 billion. All 12 boys rescued from a flooded cave in northern Thailand are described as to be in good health following their 17 ordeal, although they lost an average of 2 kilograms in weight. The last four boys and their coach were rescued late Tuesday by an international cave rescue diving team. They're being quarantined at a Thai hospital to ensure against infection. A third round of peace talks between the government of Myanmar, also known as Burma, and ethnic groups got underway in the capital, Naypyidaw, Wednesday in a renewed bid to end decades of tension and armed conflict. It is a follow-on to two previous meetings, one in 2016, a second last year, with little progress reported. The rights group Amnesty International, in a report released Thursday, accused the United Arab Emirates and its Yemeni allies of torturing detainees at a network of secret prisons in southern Yemen. The UAE and its allies deny the allegation. Amnesty said a two-year investigation documented widespread use of torture and other ill-treatment. On Wall Street, a four-day rally ended Wednesday amid rising U.S.-China trade tensions, with the benchmark Dow Jones Index falling more than 200 points to 24,700. Trade and oil futures also fell on those tensions in a range of $3.5 to $5.5 a barrel. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Thursday, July the 12th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Ugandan police use tear gas and live bullets to break up protest against a new tax targeting social media users. The protest was organized by a popular lawmaker, Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, who got into a scuffle with police as they tried to arrest him.
We are not fighting with you, officer. We are fighting for you.
Uganda's member of parliament, Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine. President Alassane Ouattara is playing down divisions within his ruling coalition days after he fired his cabinet. In Zimbabwe's opposition parties protested against the country's electoral commission. They say that the commission is plotting to rig the elections in favor of the ruling ZANU-PF. And in Gambia, the former vice president, Fatoumata Diallo Tabajang, who was recently fired from her position, has rejected a job offer to serve in the country's foreign service.
She did not resign before she was relieved. She resigned after she was informed that she would be given a position in the foreign service.
Ami Bojang Sisoho is the media director in the Gambian president's office. Those stories plus sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. In Nigeria, President Muhammadu Buhari says that his country is now ready to sign the Africa Free Trade Agreement. Buhari's government had refused to join the Continental Free Trade Zone, saying that it was looking out for its own local businesses and industries. The Continental Free Trade Zone, which encompasses 1.2 billion people, is one of the world's largest free trade areas in terms of the number of countries, covering more than 1.2 billion people and over $4 trillion in combined consumer and business spending. The agreement was initially signed by 44 African countries. Nigeria and South Africa were hesitant to sign the agreement in Kigali. Economists said that the Continental Free Trade Zone will boost African economies by harmonizing trade liberalization across sub-regions and at the continental level. As part of the agreement, countries have committed to remove tariffs on 90% of goods. According to the UN Economic Commission on Africa, intra-African trade is likely to increase by 52% and will double upon further removal of other non-tariff barriers. In Uganda's capital, Kampala, two protesters were arrested in the downtown area after a scuffle broke out between the protesters and the police. The protest was organized by a popular lawmaker, Member of Parliament Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine. Mr. Kyagulanyi is part of a number of activists and politicians who say that the recently instituted tax will have a negative impact. Police in Kampala used tear gas and live bullets as they shot in the air to break up a crowd of demonstrators led by Mr. Kyagulanyi.
Members of Parliament and the President, they should know what the people of Uganda are thinking.
We are not fighting with you, officer. We are fighting for you. This is a simple demonstration.
My brother, I am not fighting you. I am fighting for you.
That's Uganda Member of Parliament Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine. Uganda police spokesperson say that police broke up the protest because the organizers of the protest did not notify authorities before they took to the streets. Users of social media in Uganda have had to pay 200 Ugandan shillings, or about 5 cents daily, for their use of social media applications like Facebook and WhatsApp. The tax was introduced after Uganda's president, Yoweri Museveni, said that social media users use it for rumor-mongering instead of working. However, after the recent public outcry against the tax, Uganda's Prime Minister, Ruhakana Rugunda, told lawmakers yesterday that the tax on social media as well as other levies on a phone-based payment system known as mobile money, will be reviewed and the new bill tabled next week in Parliament.
Government is now reviewing the taxes, taking into consideration the concerns of the public and its implications on the budget.
Uganda's Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda speaking to lawmakers yesterday in Kampala, Uganda. And in Zimbabwe, opposition parties took to the streets Wednesday, demanding that the country's election regulators release voter rolls to be used in the July 30th general elections. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare for VOA News.
Thousands joined Nelson Chamisa, the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC Alliance, and marched to the offices of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. They held placards denouncing the commission and accusing it of rigging for the ruling ZANU-PF party to win. After a meeting with the electoral body, Chamisa explained the opposition's demands.
The ballot paper has to be done in a transparent manner. We must agree, we must observe, we must be accountable and open. The issue of the voter's roll has to be done in terms of the law. We must have a biometric voter's roll with pictures, with everything, as per the law.
The 40-year-old politician told his supporters that the opposition would permanently camp out at the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission if ZEC does not give in to their demands. The opposition wants the electoral body to release the actual voters' roll so it can be checked for ghost voters. Political commentator Rejoice Ngwenya says Zimbabwe risks more protests and another disputed election if the electoral commission does not release the voters' roll and the ballot paper as per opposition demands.
They are creating a dossier of challenging the credibility of the result. Because if there's going to be an electoral court after the elections, those that are aggrieved will simply say, look, we are not happy. We don't believe the results are reflecting the expression of the people because of this. Because these are the kind of issues that have to be catalogued that can be basis for litigation. I believe that the integrity of the elections is already under question. And this demonstration can then be catalogued together with other cases to show cause that the election, the process has been totally free, unfair, and not credible.
Under former President Robert Mugabe's almost four decade-long rule, which ended last November, elections were always disputed. His successor, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has promised a credible election by allowing Western observers. The opposition says that is not enough. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
And in Burundi, students have called on their government to reconsider the ban on pregnant girls from reintegrating into formal education. This comes after Burundi Education Minister announced that the ban will affect both pregnant girls and expectant fathers. Moses Havyarimana has more on this story from Burundi's capital, Bujumbura.
Burundi Education Minister's announcement to ban pregnant girls from reintegrating in the formal education after giving birth has raised the concerns in schools. Students and teachers have called on the government to reverse the decision, saying that it will negatively affect the young generation as 65% of the country's 11 million population are youth. Luis Nahimana is one of the teachers in a high school in Bujumbura.
There is a problem of poverty in our country. That's a first. So I think the minister, what can be done right now is consultation. What is the reason? What are the causes of that problem?
Almost 80% of the Burundi's population live under poverty, and among the major causes of the school dropouts or early pregnancies in the country is related to the financial difficulties. Irakoze Chelsea is a student in one of the high schools in Bujumbura. She says that the move will impact the development of the country.
The measures taken by the Ministry of Education seems to me wrong. Why not even a solution to the problem? If I can give an example, for me, I want to study many faculties, But if I get pregnant, for example, I will have that problem to achieve that purpose that I gave to my life. So it will be very difficult for me to develop my country that I love so much.
Shadrach Nizeyimana is a student at Burundi University.
As we know, girls, these vocational trainings are not well adapted for them. Where they will see that they are banned from schools, like private or public, is like to stop their dream of attaining their goals in the future. It's like it's stopping their success.
Analysts say the move to ban pregnant girls from accessing formal education after giving birth risks the increase of abortion in the country. Agathon Rwasa is a lawmaker and the deputy speaker of the Burundi Parliament.
The mission of education is to give knowledge and to get knowledge for the pupils. Measures can be a little bit sounding harsh, but it is a reaction to the situation. If there is no consensus about this, it can be discussed after all. This is not a law. It has just been a decision by the minister who is in charge.
The Burundi government says that the ban of pregnant girls from going back to school after maternity period is meant to discourage the rising number of early pregnancy in the country. But human rights organizations say that this violates the rights of the girls to access education. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Gambia's first vice president, Fatoumata Jaro Tambajang, has rejected a job offer extended to her by President Adama Barrow to serve in the country's foreign service. The former vice president was recently fired, together with a host of other ministers, in a major cabinet reshuffle made by the Gambian leader. Reporter Pat Nderimba has more on this story.
Former vice president Fatoumata Jaro Tambajang has parted company with the Barrow-led coalition government. She has not only declined to accept a job offer to serve in Gambia's foreign service, but she has also resigned as the chairperson of the coalition government. Amibojan Sisoho is the director of press at the president's office.
President Barrow also accepted the resignation of former Vice President Fatoumata Tambajang from the government and the offer to serve in the foreign service in a letter dated 4th of July.
Tambajang, in a statement issued shortly after her sacking, thanked President Barrow and her former cabinet colleagues for the support they rendered to her during her tenure in office. She says her new mission as a private citizen is to continue championing for democracy, sustainable peace, and development. Amibojan Sisoho again.
She did not resign before she was relieved. She resigned after she was informed that she will be given a position in the Foreign Service. Well, she declined it based on personal reasons and professional reasons. That's what she said in the letter. So, and it was accepted by the president.
So far, two coalition government ministers have been fired since President Barrow came to power in December of 2016. First to be shown the exit door was Interior Minister Mai Fati, to be followed by Agriculture Minister Omar Amadi Jallo, OJ. Pa Samba Jow is a Washington, D.C.-based Gambian human rights activist.
Well, very interesting, and I would think that maybe she has seen that as a demotion from being a vice president to maybe being an ambassador or something.
Tambajang stayed on the job for about a year before she was confirmed as vice president. This was due to her age, because the constitution at the time said people who are more than the age of 65 years are disqualified to serve as vice president. Parliament had to change the law to cater for her appointment. Activist Pa Samba Jow recalled meeting Tambajang in Washington, D.C. this past year during a community meeting where Tambajang said she was ready to serve the government under any capacity.
I was at that meeting, and we questioned the idea of holding the position for her, that it was important for President Barrow to abide by the constitution and appoint a vice president, and they must not amend the constitution just so that she would become vice president. The VP, in response, said something that was extremely interesting, that as far as he was concerned, even if the president had appointed her as a cleaner, she would do that because he was out to do nothing but to work for the Gambian people.
Jow believes that Tambajang's past statements on the issue of serving one's country doesn't reconcile with her recent decision?
I would want to say that most people will see this as a contradiction from those comments that were made by the former VP when she came to Washington, D.C. and met with the Cabinet Committee.
In a Twitter posting on Wednesday, the former vice president said her passion for national development, social justice, and peace building is stronger than ever. For now, she said, she wants to live the life of a private citizen. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
And the Kenyan government has called on its citizens to appreciate the job done by Chinese companies after workers on the new Nairobi to Mombasa railway complained of mistreatment and discrimination. Among other issues, the workers say they're not being given a chance to operate the train. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The Kenyan government is coming under pressure to protect its workers from alleged abuses by the Chinese builders of the standard gauge railway that was launched in 2017. In recent weeks, Kenyan media have been awash with reporting and images of what appears to show Kenyan workers being mistreated. One image showed dozens of workers lying on their stomachs. The Kenyan government has promised to take action against those behind the abuses. However, government spokesman Eric Kiraithe says his fellow countrymen's behavior at work is also to blame.
Even as we talk about the Madaraka Express and racism and all that, it might be necessary for us as a country to change our work ethic.
Kiraithe calls on Kenyans working at the newly constructed railway to learn from the Chinese on how to operate and service it so that they can take over in the future without difficulties.
What we are expecting those Kenyans to do, those with an opportunity, is to shift the focus on the challenge at hand. We are aware as a government there are forces which are not very friendly to that project.
The Chinese financed railway has also come under criticism from environmental activists because the rail developers decided to pass the train through a national park. According to Kenyan media, the train has hit buffaloes and lions. The government said the accidents were unintentional. Reinhard Bonke works with the Friends of Nairobi National Park.
Right now, you see, they passed the railway and there's already three roads that are being proposed to go through the same Nairobi National Park. So that's what you're trying to protect. And again, when the rail goes to the park, we have, you know, invasive species that should go through, issue with the, you know, pollution inside the park. And we don't know yet, but eastward poaching could be an issue. So all these things will lead to the depletion of the park.
The government insists it's satisfied with the plans to protect the animals in the parks and along the railway line. Conservationists say those plans are inadequate. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Meteorological Organization warns that floods, heat waves, and other extreme weather conditions gripping many parts of the world are likely to continue as a consequence of accelerating climate change. For more on this, Lisa Schlein's reports for VOA from the WMO headquarters in Geneva.
While the world was fixated on the dramatic rescue from a cave in Thailand of 12 boys and their soccer coach, potentially deadly monsoon rains were gathering steam in the region. The World Meteorological Organization reports extreme weather conditions have dealt a deadly blow in many places, with blistering heat waves and disastrous precipitation forecast to continue this month. For example, it notes the recent catastrophic flooding in Japan, the worst in decades, has claimed at least 150 lives. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says the death toll is likely to climb. This in what she calls one of the world's best prepared countries when it comes to tackling disasters.
They are supremely well prepared. And so the magnitude of the casualties of the destruction that we're seeing now really is an indication of just how big and how extreme this was and how heavy the rainfall was in such a short period of time.
Other extreme weather events include drought and abnormally high temperatures in northern Europe. The WMO expects these conditions to prevail over the coming weeks. The WMO reports the United States has had the hottest June on record. Nullis notes the Los Angeles area in California continues to hit record high temperatures, such as 48.9 degrees Celsius in the city of Chino. Elsewhere in the world, she says a city in the Algerian Sahara Desert has reported temperatures of 51.3 degrees Celsius.
Climate change, as we always say, no specific event can be attributed to climate change, but what we're seeing is consistent with climate change scenarios. Extreme heat, consistent heat, persistent heat, and heavy precipitation.
WMO scientists say these extreme weather events are compatible with the general long-term trend of global warming caused by the emission of man-made greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And now for some World Cup news with Samson O'Malley. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson, and welcome to the latest update from the 2018 FIFA World Cup here in Russia. Croatia came from behind on Wednesday to beat England 2-1 as Mario Mandzukic extra time goal sent them into their first World Cup final and a possible revenge mission against France. England's bid to reach a first World Cup final since 1966 came to an agonizing end as they lost in extra time. Juventus striker Mario Mandzukic scored a winning goal in the 109th minute of the semi-final, slotting in from Ivan Perisic's flick on. Croatia became the 13th team to contest the final and the first new finalist since Spain in 2010. Jubilant Croatian fans honked their car horns and let out fireworks after their team's victory. For England fans, it was a disappointing night. Meanwhile, spectators at Wednesday's World Cup semi-final in the Russian capital booed and whistled Croatia defender Domagoj Vidar, who had spoken out in support of Russia's neighbor and adversary Ukraine. After Croatia's quarterfinal victory over Russia, a video was posted online showing Vidar, a former player with Ukrainian club side Dynamo Kiev, saying glory to Ukraine. World Soccer's governing body FIFA ruled that Vidar's comments were not keeping with tournament rules about political neutrality. In other news, the World Cup has been marred by an estimated 300 cases of sexism on the streets, tarnishing an otherwise positive tournament, the head of an anti-discrimination group, FAIR, has said. Piera Parr said that after monitoring discrimination in European soccer and working with FIFA at the 2018 FIFA World Cup, victims had included Russian women harassed by fans and television reporters who had been accosted while broadcasting. He added that there had been around 30 cases of reporters who had been accosted on air. FIFA has fined England 70,000 Swiss franc and Uruguay were given a 50,000 Swiss franc sanction for breaking media and marketing rules during the World Cup. FIFA added that the Football Association had previously been asked to desist. No specific details were given, but Croatia and Sweden were previously fined because players wore unauthorized ankle socklets over their team kit or took a drink with a non-sponsor's logo onto the field. Elsewhere in Saudi Arabia, soccer governing body FIFA has said that it has engaged legal counsel to take action in Saudi Arabia against television channel BRQ, which is widely available in the kingdom, for continuing to illegally broadcast the 2018 World Cup. FIFA last month warned that it was exploring all options to stop the infringement of its right over BRQ's airing of the opening games of the soccer tournament taking place in Russia. And finally, FIFA Secretary General Fatima Samora said on Wednesday that Russia's staging of the Soccer World Cup has set the bar high for Qatar, the tournament's next host in 2022. Samora asked Matvienko to convey to Russian President Vladimir Putin FIFA's profound appreciation for everything that he has done to make it possible for the world to watch the beautiful game. And that's the latest World Cup news update from Moscow. I am Samson O'Malley. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good day. And that's it for this Thursday, July the 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the upset-filled 2018 FIFA World Cup wraps up on Sunday. All five of the teams from Africa, Nigeria, Egypt, Senegal, Morocco and Tunisia were knocked out in the preliminary rounds. A discussion on the World Cup on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.